Hello, everyone. Welcome back to ThreatSight Podcast. We are now discussing events from May of 2024. And today we are having a special guest. As always, this special guest is Dead Roses XYZ, also known as Jordan. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor being here with you, man.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you. But before, I'm also joined with my co-host, Escrow. Hello, Escrow.
Hello, hello. This is going to be a very good episode.
Yes, definitely. Like, we have a superstar security researcher joining us today. So definitely, I hope that it will be very unique and very cool talk. So, without any further ado, let's start. Guys, like, I have question first to you, Dead Roses. Could you please, like, tell something about yourself to everyone that is listening to this podcast?
Sure. So, some little background about me. I'm 19 years old. I'm another Bulgarian auditor, part of the squad, you know. I originally started as a bug hunter, built most of my reputation through bug hunting on Immunify. And I joined Spearbeats in April and been working with them since.
Damn, amazing. Another, like, superstar auditor from Bulgaria, under 20 years old. How are you doing that, guys?
No, it's magic. It's magic, yeah.
So Jordan, what was your background prior to Web3 security?
Well, basically, like, as you can probably guess, I'm 19, so I don't really have any tech background. In my last year of high school, I discovered Web3, and so I decided to just dive deep into it. And right when I graduated, I just went all in, decided I'm going to be a full-time security researcher. And, like, the interesting part was that I took that decision without actually having much of a results as of then. So, yeah. I don't really have any tech background. I just decided to dive into Web3 security. It was a high-risk, high-reward situation, which actually played out well. So I'm pretty grateful for that.
Yeah, that's actually amazing. It sounds like you played your cards completely correctly.
Yeah.
Tip. I wish I had such an opportunity to talk to you earlier. This is just amazing how you just drop everything else that was there and just follow that without any promise that you will make it, because of course many people are here and not making it, right? Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that I was actually accepted into university and it was just something that I wasn't really passionate about, so I was like, all right, if I don't want to not take risks in order to just go and study something that I won't really be interested in. So might as well just try and risk it. Like, worst case scenario, what, I would just waste 1 year. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, obviously it's not something good, but, you know, you just gotta take some risks, man. I was actually just pretty grateful that I was in such a situation because, like, I didn't really have as much to risk. Like, if this opportunity came, like, 10 years later, I would have had much more to lose. So, yeah, just, I was a bit lucky to be at the right place at the right time.
Super cool. So, yeah, then apart from that, this is just a part of thinking outside of the box. Like, just what you said, the worst thing that will happen to me, I will lose 1 year. Nothing big, right? I'm 19 years old. Who cares?
Amazing. Yeah, it wouldn't really be a wasted year. Because, like, it would be a year of experience. Like, yeah, maybe I would have been, like, financially stable after this 1 year. I would have some troubles. But after all, it would be some useful experience, which I would use in later in my life. So it's all honestly a win-win situation.
I agree with that. I very much agree.
Yeah.
So, Jordan, based on you saying that you had no tech background, you know, before entering Web3 security, I guess this question is actually very relevant. And I'm wondering, what was one of the biggest challenges that you faced in Web3 security?
Well, like, probably the biggest challenge was just getting disciplined to work the hours needed. Like, obviously, coming out of school with no previous work experience, I didn't really have that discipline in the beginning. And it was something that I had to, you know, kind of build. So, yeah, it was just very hard because, like, in the first days, it was like, okay, I'll just put 2 hours of work today, maybe 3 hours tomorrow, like, something like that. I couldn't put, like, 8 hours or 10 hours a day. But, yeah, eventually, you just need to kind of do this stuff for a long period of time, and you get used to it. So, yeah.
I agree. And more importantly, you also have to enjoy it. A lot of people, you know, do it for the money as well. And I do tend to see that the auditors that do it for fun versus the ones who do it purely for money, the ones who do it for fun just succeed at a higher level because it's really incomparable in terms of the mindset.
Could be. I mean, I'm not necessarily agreeing with this, honestly. It is like, I can see someone money-driven being extremely successful. Like, I don't like to say that being money-driven is wrong. Like, I don't believe in that. And there is nothing wrong. As long as you do anything, everything honestly, and you don't do, I don't know, you're not dishonest, there's nothing bad with, like, being money-driven. I don't like this idea of just shaming people who do it for money. I mean,
yeah, no, I definitely understand your point. It's just, you know, doing something for fun. It's more specifically in regards to this being such a technical field. You know, there's a lot of digging to do, a lot of learning to do. So that's why I kind of made the point of you have to really enjoy it if you want to succeed in it massively. Because if you do look at it purely from the perspective of money, it's not really going to be on par with just doing it for fun.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be harder if you're not interested in it.
Yeah, and I think that there is, like, this distinction, like, for someone that already has established career and, like, for example, a pre can give him, like, 2x or 3x of what he already has, the incentive is not as big and the motivation, motivation is not as big as for someone who, like, for whom the amount of money that he can get is, like unbelievable. Yeah, so I think that this also diverse people and their motivations. And like talking about the money, you won, like, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe I have some outdated information, but from what I know, you won over $100,000 on Immunify in 3 months. That was from like 12 paid reports that you had. And also you received elite rank on Immunify. And my question is, how did you achieve that?
Oh, yeah, that's a nice question. So basically, we need to roll back a bit in time. And if you followed the field back in last August, September, you know that in September there was a drought of contests. There was no contests. And this was just the time which I really wanted to put all my hours into this. And I really wanted to do contests all the time, and there were no contests. So I just had to find something new in which I would spend time. And back then I was thinking, okay, Immunify is this thing for experts, for some elites, for some ungodly human beings. And yeah, I just had no choice, but I decided to still give it a try. And this was in September, I believe. And I got lucky to find my first book in, I believe, like 2 or 3 days, something like that. And I was like, okay, if I can find one, I can probably find another one. So I was like, okay, I'm going to stick to this thing. And in October, I hit a big. In October, I hit like 50K in bounties. And I was like, okay, this is my thing. Because this is a huge, like, I don't know, 10, 15X in my income, like, in just a single month. So I was like, okay, maybe I'm good at this thing. Maybe I'm not made for contests. Maybe I'm made for book hunting. Maybe this is more of my thing. I decided to just go all in, full dive into it, just find whatever I'm passionate about, like in terms of projects, and just fully dive into them. And as soon as you do that, you realize that, okay, nobody's perfect. The devs can always miss something. All of these projects have bugs in them. You just have to find them. And yeah, I just spent like 3 months bug hunting, and I hit the elite rank. And this was actually my goal. I don't know why, but the idea of having this elite hoodie is just something that kept me driving, like, kept me pushing.
Yeah, like, definitely. How much people do have elite rank, do you know?
Well, I suppose the number is somewhere around 100, because, like, currently I believe ranked 93rd or something like that, and I have just over 100k earnings, so I suppose it's somewhere around that mark.
Interesting.
So apart from Unify, of course, you did also contests, and in one of your tweets you mentioned that you did contests full time for a month. And could you please describe your experience doing contests full time and your thoughts on competitive audits in general?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I was mainly doing private audits before then, and all of a sudden, there were like 4 contests in parallel, and in the course of a week, they became 20 in parallel. So I was like, okay, there are a lot of contests. I just have to choose the right ones, and I'm going to make more money than I can possibly make from private audits. So I decided to just give it a try, just because like everybody was saying that contests are not as good as they are, and I was like, okay, you guys clearly don't understand the game. So I decided to dive into them. Doing contests full time is great in terms of like learning new stuff, because you're constantly learning new stuff. Contests are absolutely amazing in terms of learning, because you have so many great minds thinking in so many different ways, and you always miss something. So this was a very good aspect of it, because I could actually feel that my skills are getting better and better. So this was definitely a big plus. But at the same time, as I mentioned in your pro, so it's a bit of a soul draining experience, yeah. Because the whole escalations thing is just mentally draining, because it's just who can convince the judge in something that's not actually true. That's all about it. So, yeah. But at the same time, I do believe that the advantage of doing contests are more than the drawbacks. So it's still worth it. You have to deal with this inconvenience.
Okay, so you mentioned that you are improving really fast. And do you have any specific approach to improve with each contest? Are you like then only reading the report and like noting what you missed, or is there something more to that?
All right, so basically, the strategy I use, which will not make you earn the most in every single competition, but will overall make you the best player, is just doing the contest until you reach the point where it's not worth your time. Because usually you reach that point quite fast. You'd find most of your submissions, let's say if it's a 7-day contest, you'd find most of them in the first 2 days. And so there would likely be another issue which you would find if you spend 5 more days in it. But if you look at it in the way as of the rewards, it's not going to be worth it to spend that extra 5 days just for one issue more. So yeah, as soon as you realize that, okay, my time is not worth spending any more time into that code base, you jump right into another one, and you keep doing the same over all of the contests that are running in parallel for as long as you can, basically. And then, sometime 2 weeks go by, the results are out, you check the results, you will miss something. You will obviously not reach full coverage with this approach, but in terms of contests, that's okay, because you miss a bug. What about it? No big deal. And yeah, you just keep on doing that for a long enough period of time, and you will become one of the best for sure.
This is super cool tip. Like, this is contrary to the, I think, what most people are saying is just grind all the contests, even if you think that you won't find anything more, just grind, to the last minute of the contest until you find everything there. And your approach is spend as little time as you can to have the biggest rewards. We can say that according to Pareto rules, spend 20% on the contest, find as much as you can in this time, and if you feel that you are stuck and finding yet another one will really require significant time investment, just move on. And this is actually super interesting, because that way, if you are only spending 2, 3, 4 days on a contest, you have more volume of the contests, right? Because instead of doing only one contest in a week, you can do 2 or 3 of them in a week. Yeah. Super interesting.
Exactly. But the thing is that I don't want everybody listening to this to just follow this blindly, because this is true as long as
like, it's a bit of a game theory. Because, like, if everybody just now listens to this and starts doing this, is it going to become actually more worth spending more time on the contest because the findings that you will find for the localization will be even more unique? So this is thing that it's true as of right now, may not be true in the future. It all depends on how different contestants look at the contests.
But are you able to find, like, many unique findings doing that, or it's just... you know, more that you have broader coverage that you, like, for example, find everything that, like, most of the issues that other people found, but because you found the most of them, you will, like, just have a good ranking on this contest.
I believe you can find the unique ones, too. Like, I have not enough big sample size regarding my contest. I probably led, like, what, 6 or 7 contests of Sherlock, and they were all small ones, which basically had no unique findings for most of them. So, you know, if there's no opportunity to find a unique finding, then there's no opportunity to find a unique finding. But yeah, I do believe that you can find them.
Amazing. And it also, like, connects to, yeah, because I did, like, research on you on Twitter. So you wrote, and I really like what you wrote in one of your tweets. You were saying that do what everyone else does and you will get what everyone else gets. So, like, you just gave the perfect example of that, just, like, spending as little as possible to get the broadest coverage. But is there anything else that you are doing, you know, contrary to the, like, popular belief?
I don't know. I don't really know what is the popular belief regarding most of the stuff. The only thing that maybe I can just share as a thing that I do is that I don't have any exact schedule. Like, I always been like that. I audit when I feel like auditing. When I feel tired, I take a rest. And that's all about it. There is no secret magic. There is no Pomodoro. There is no, like, taking a break every X minutes. Man, you just gotta, you know, listen to yourself. Like, no. If you feel tired, no need to force yourself too much. If you feel like you have a bunch of energy, dive into a cold race. It's as simple as that.
Exactly. You try to be comfortable, right?
Yeah.
But, like, without Pomodoro, like, everyone is using that. And I'm just joking. Yeah, I also tried Pomodoro, and I'm also not the kind of person. This is super cool.
Yeah, I tried it as well, but I didn't really like it either. I think it's okay. It works sometimes. I think it really depends on the task that you're doing. I feel like for auditing, like, it can work, but I mean, you know, just anecdotally speaking, it just didn't work for me. But it's a good technique anyway.
I don't know. Like, the way, like, from my experience, I usually, when I get interested in a code base, like, that actually flies. Like, no kidding. I can just, all of a sudden, I've been staring at the same lines of code for hours. And I can't imagine just an alarm going on and I'd be like, oh, it's time for my break. Like, no.
Exactly. Yeah.
We should be able to get into a flow state where you can just work for long hours. That's it.
Mm. I agree.
And how many hours per day usually do you work?
Oh, this actually varies a lot. Like, it all depends on how much work I've taken, because sometimes I take on more work than I should supposedly be able to, and there are weeks where I can work like 12 hours a day for 7 days straight, and I'm like, that's it. But yeah, that's definitely not sustainable. I can't do this like all the time. These are just short periods of time. But if we have to average it out, I suppose it would be like something like 7 hours a day of full focused work, like where I'm actually just as productive as I can possibly be. And there was like 2-3 hours extra where I'm like semi-productive, you know, like just maybe writing a POC or maybe just reading something out of interest, reading a bug report, like something like that, you know. But yeah, like productive work probably around the 7 hours a day mark.
Okay.
So, like, given that you work so many hours sometimes, do you get burnt out as well? Or do you just, you know, not believe in being burnt out and just keep going?
Well, it's not like I don't believe in burnout. Yeah, I believe you can probably get burnout, but it's not as easy as people say it is. I don't know. Like, if I work so much in a single week, I will not get burned out for sure. Like, if I do it for a month, maybe. But yeah, like, the thing is that if I work so much in a week, like, I don't necessarily need a rest for, like, the next week or something. I can just do 4 hours of work for like 2 days, and I'm just back to normal. That's it. I believe people kind of lie to themselves that they're burnt out. It's more of like, it's all in your head. Or at least I believe so, yeah.
Okay, moving on. There is like two biggest approaches to charging for audits, and you know, just to do an audit. Like, one of them is paper vulnerability, and another one is just traditional. You know, you know what you will pay beforehand, and you get the service and call. What is your take on both of those approaches? Like, which one do you think is better? Which one has, you know, some virtues over the other? And what you personally prefer?
Well, I've honestly used both of them, like, depending on the client, because I usually, like, just listen to what they like more. And the thing is that I had, absolutely flawless experience with the paper vulnerability ones. But I'd like to just not to do them, like, one. I like to know how much I'm getting paid, like, that's it. And two, I believe, like, all it takes is one time that we don't reach an agreement with the client, and it's going to be a pain. So, yeah, I just like to know how much I'm going to get, be absolutely sure about it. You know, some people say that if you do PPV, you're going to do better because you're incentivized. Like, at the end of the day, you're always incentivized to do your best. Like, you put your name behind it, you got to do your best.
Okay, like, as long as you are not doing, like, super big auditing company, like Certic, for example, who, like, just can't find enough people to audit it and, like, drops in quality, it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also see, like right now, that many people are, including me, are, you know, joining together and form a teams. I know that you also worked in a team many times. In your opinion, why solo audits are not as good as everyone believes?
Well, there are like multiple reasons. So to begin with, like, you don't improve from them. Like, you stay at the same level. If you, for example, start doing solo audits only, and you do that for a year, and you get back to like contests or something like that, you'd be at the bottom of the leaderboard. You wouldn't improve, and in fact, you'd only get worse because you'd just forget some attack paths and stuff like that. You don't realize what you've missed, which is also a huge drawback. Well, like, if you work in a team, you can see what you've missed, and there is room for improvement always. Also, like, something else regarding the why solo audits are not as good, like, they don't really pay as well as everybody believes they do. Like, because usually the projects which go for solo audits are with lower budgets, so basically you can't charge them like a firm, and at the same time you can earn the same type of money from doing contests, but from contests you don't put your reputation at risk. Well, once again, all it takes is just one bad audit, the protocol gets exploited, and it kind of gets a reputation doomed. So yeah, I believe just people shouldn't believe that the ultimate goal. I'm sorry. The ultimate goal is to become a solo auditor. Like, there is much more than just this.
This is a very good point that you just mentioned, that you are just no improving, and you do not have this feedback on what you miss. And I think that this is a problem with people who do security research in some company, like any company, like including consensus intelligence, Open Zeppelin. I'm not specifically picking on those companies, but it just, like, if you are working for one company only and you do not have this feedback loop, like, how do you know, if you get better, worse, or, you know, what's your level? Like, you can know that.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, another drawback which I forgot to mention is that if you've worked with, like, many clients, you probably know that most of the people that come to solo audits are more or less pump and dump projects. Like, you wouldn't get the actual nice, interesting, novel projects, like creating something new, creating something interesting. They rarely come for solo audits. Well, the projects which come are just, you know, something that you're not going to be proud that you've audited.
Okay, yeah, definitely. And, like, apart from that, yeah, what you said, if the project, you know, is just another meme coin or, you know, another ERC20, like, you are really not improving. Like, there is nothing new to learn from it.
Yeah. Like,
exactly.
I actually have a question for the both of you. So how would you view being audited by somebody who doesn't have, let's say, very good solo stats, but they have very good team stats in terms of bugs found on Code Arena, for instance, you know, Sherlock, etc.? Would that change your perspective of the auditor?
You basically mean someone who is inexperienced in solo audits but has contest experience?
Yes, yes, yes. So somebody who's just constantly participated with different people in a Code Arena team, for instance, rather than just participating solo. Do you think that affects their credibility in some sort of sense?
Yeah, of course. Like, you just can know if this guy actually had enough contribution in the result. So there's all going to be a drawback. Like, they may be bad, they may be good. If they want to have the credibility, they have to go out solo, have to compete solo, and just prove for themselves. Which actually, by the way, is something which was a little drawback for me personally. When I started doing Code Arena more, my first big results were all in the team. And you can't really show this to people and like, make exposure out of it to just get clients. Because it's a team result. And yeah, I suggest like, if you want to earn money from contests, probably do it as a team. But if you want to get the credibility and show the world your skills, you have to do it solo.
Yeah, that's a very nice perspective.
Yeah, like I'm on the opposite side of the spectrum. Like I totally agree with what you said. However, like I'm in one team since January, and yeah, of course, this is hard to tell. In our case, it's like we are. Each one of us has like different set of virtues and looks at the code in different ways. And it's like, whenever I miss something, Sori finds this vulnerability because he just looks at it differently. And yeah, the question is, you know, will your skills be suitable? And yeah, as you said, like you don't really know what the other person brought to the table. And if they're there, you know, only because, you know, they are friends with the guy that does all the work, or they are, like, really good, or maybe they are the one that really leads in this team. Hard to tell. Yeah,
exactly my thoughts.
So, Jordan, I'm curious. Is there, like, a specific auditor that you look up to in terms of success or knowledge?
Well, to be fair, yeah, there's probably a few of them. So, on the top of my head, Riptide, Aslitz, Goat, you know, Gothic Shannon, he's a bug hunter, absolutely amazing. Lonely Slot, another bug hunter who's out of this world. Zach O'Bron is someone who I also look up to. Like, these are at least the ones on top of my head, which they're absolute beasts. Like, if I had to get my products audited, I'd probably go to one of them.
Yeah, that's a nice list.
Yeah, like, there's probably a lot more that which I have forgot to mention. There's so many great researchers.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like, and the list is constantly growing. And yeah, like, most of the people that you mentioned are specifically bug hunting. They do not do like a lot of contests. Question is, do you feel like there is something different, you know, between the people that do contests and are successful with that from the people that do bug hunting and have successes with that? Because, like, you specifically have successes on both of the fields. However, do you feel, is there anything specific, any set of skills or, you know, just mindset or anything that it might be to make you more successful in bug hunting versus competitive audits?
The way I see it is that bug hunting is simply harder. That's it. And if someone is has success in bug hunting, in my eyes, he's better than someone who's good in contests. And the thing is that in bug hunting, you have to be absolutely able to prove that this thing has actual impact and it's not just purely theoretical. It's not just some bullshit. It has to have an impact. You have to be able to exploit it, and that's it. You can't go around it. Well, in contests, you can just get paid a few thousand dollars because an EIP is not followed. Like, this is not the actual impact. There is no actual impact. Funds cannot be stolen, you know. So the way I see it is that bug hunting is just harder, and it gets you a better understanding of reality. You need to experience bug hunting in order to properly understand how everything works. Because if you go to contest results, you can clearly see which people have never, ever submitted a bug report and try to get it validated. Because the stuff they try to make it seem like high impact is negligible impact.
Yeah, like, blame the game, not the player. Like, I think that it was C-Michel that mentioned it. Yeah, of course, like, the game is... Yeah, sometimes the submission that got accepted are really strange. So, yeah, definitely. It's just, like, how good you can prove your point, like, sometimes, no matter, you know, what the real impact is, as you said, like, of course, if you are not following EAP, like, what's the real issue? Maybe there is some issue, but maybe it's just so theoretical that it won't be ever, like, real issue.
Yeah, but something you mentioned is pretty good on point. You shouldn't blame the players. You should blame the game. Like, I wouldn't necessarily attack any researcher because they've submitted something which I don't believe should be validated. Like, it's just part of the game. They've done their part. They want to make an honest living. They're doing so. Nothing bad about it. But yeah, I do believe some changes needed to contests. And I can see, like, pretty much all major platforms trying to go into the right direction, which is obviously awesome. And I hope they actually do. It's not an easy task because it's not just black and white. But to be fair, I see some progress. So that's obviously good.
Maybe there is something in traditional security that we can, you know, just take from. Escrow, do you think about, you know, how can we improve on, like, judging the issues?
I mean, I think the strongest point here that we can talk about is, like Jordan said earlier, regarding the theoretical side of when you report bugs through a contest, whereas, you know, like on Immunify, in actual bug hunting, you go with purely realistic scenarios that can happen then and there. It's like in Web 2 bug bounty hunting, that is quite literally how it is. You're purely arguing, the realistic side of it rather than pure theory. If you try and argue theory, I mean, you're not really going to get far with it. Obviously, it depends massively on context, but 9 times out of 10, again, like I'm saying, you won't get far with it. It really depends what we want to argue with in regards to implementing some of the Web 2 tactics in Web 3, because it does vary on every single facet, so to speak.
Yeah, like, maybe some kind of standardization would help here. But on the other hand, like, what is the worst thing that may happen in Web 2? Probably maybe some user data will be leaked, or I don't know, like, and here, like, even the theoretical issue maybe will be exploited somehow. So this is, like, really hard, you know, to put the straight line on, you know, where it's where it will never happen and it's just theory, and when it might really happen. Okay, and yeah, Jordan, you mentioned that, like, you try to move as fast as you can, but in order to move really fast through the code base, you first have to quickly understand the code base. And what is approach that you take to really understand the code base in such a pace that you do?
Well, you're going to be surprised, but it's actually rather simple. You just open a random file and go from top to bottom. That's it. You just probably skip the constructor and that's it. But that's the magic, man. Just go top to bottom. That's it.
Yeah, like, I, I always think that you will tell, you know, like specific like 20-step formula on how you approach things, and it's just like bang. I just read the code. Get lost.
Yeah.
you know the mid-curve meme, like with the guys on the left and the right. I just read code.
Yeah, on the left. Yeah, and in the middle, I follow these steps that I do. Yeah, first I skim through to get the interactions, and then yada yada yada. And on the right, I just read code top to bottom. That's all.
Yeah. And also, the thing about it is that now, once you get enough experience, like probably when you get like 2,000 hours of auditing, you will get the idea of the code rather quickly. Like it doesn't take like significant amount of time because you've seen most of the stuff. Like unless you're auditing, I don't know, Uniswap 4 or something like that, you'd get the idea in a matter of minutes, like probably what, 10, 15, 20 minutes, something like that. You will already have seen almost everything.
Yeah, it becomes muscle memory, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically almost the exact same philosophy when it comes to Web2 hunting, you know? When you've got a lot of experience in, let's say, like, I don't know, SQL injection, right? Sometimes it's very easy to just test for it because it becomes muscle memory. You know it inside out, and it's like, you know, sometimes, well, at the very start of the journey, it took like an hour or two to find it, and then 3 years later, it's taken like less than 5 minutes to find it. So yeah, it's very true. It does become quite literally muscle memory.
And do you write a lot of POCs when you are, you know, just verifying your leads?
To be completely honest, I rarely write POCs right now. It's also that I do write POCs only for Immutify. So all of my subjects on Immutify, I do have a POC, but that's just about it. And now that I don't mainly bug hunt on Immutify, I rarely do them. I don't do them for contests simply because they're not required and they would take a lot of time, which, and, you know, time is valuable. So unless a sponsor requires it, I don't write any POCs. And I also just have this also in when I offer private audits, I do tell every client, if you do issue a POC for a specific issue, please do tell me. I'll do write one, but unless you specifically ask me to, I will not.
Okay, cool. Understandable. Specifically for you, you know, you're trying to maximize your outcome. And POCs, like, first of all, they take time to write. And many times, the developers are writing so many abstractions over their tests that they test very specific things that they planned on testing. But if you want to do something, you know, that is outside of the bounds, like what security researchers usually do, they are trying to find things that are, you know, outside of the bounds and outside of the ways that normal user will use it. And in those specific cases, the PO, like the test cases that developers have are not helpful at all. And you end up like rewriting the test from the scratch many times.
Yeah, it's a pain when this happens. No, just to talk a bit more about this topic, because I suppose some beginners should take this advice. Do not take this blindly. If you are a beginner in the space, it's actually a great experience to write POCs. It really does help you understand how everything works. There's sometimes some errors which you couldn't ever imagine about, which you can just find through writing POCs. Because most of the times, you write the first POC, and there will be something unexpected happening, and sometimes these things lead to an issue, and you just kind of get to understand the system properly. So if you have hard time understanding the system as a beginner, writing POCs could help you a lot.
Yeah, like 100% agree with that. And sometimes on competitive audit platforms, like for example, in Codorina, you have a bonus if your lead is selected for the report. And many times, what differs the report that is selected for report from the others is that it has coded POC. Like many times, it's the case. So definitely, on the beginning of your journey, you may earn like some super sweet bonus just because you have POC. And apart from that, you can like verify it and just gain more knowledge through doing that.
Yeah, exactly, but I don't believe that this bonus, monetary bonus, should be the thing that makes you write the POCs. Especially in the beginning, you shouldn't be too focused on the money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is probably something that many people do as a mistake. They get too focused on the money in the beginning. Like, just focus on getting better. It's as simple as that. As long as you can provide value, you will be able to make money. So don't, if you cannot really provide value, don't try to make the most money, but rather try to be able in the future to offer more value. Just get your skills better, try to improve, and you'll reach a level where just the money will come.
Definitely.
You have a very good mindset, Jordan.
Thank you.
Very, very nice.
Yeah, like, and I think that many people, when they are starting out and, like, they are driven by money, like, they see all those people, you know, just earning tens of thousands of dollars per month. And, yeah, like, someone that has success overnight, like, not specifically overnight, but many times, like, half a year, and they think, okay, yeah, so I'm gonna spend 6 months and I'm gonna, you know, earn this money. And the 6 months mark passes and they are not in the place. Like, they maybe earned $1,000 total over the 6 months and they are saying, like, screw that.
No, exactly. This was actually kind of the point I was making at the very start, you know. It's like, if you have literally two beginners and one's literally, again, doing it for fun and the other one's doing it for money, let's say they both succeed, or let's say one succeeds and the other one fails. The person who might be doing it purely for money, for instance, it might create a bit of stress. And then it's like, it's just a spiral from there, because you're not doing it for the fun side. You're doing it purely for money. So, you know, there's a very big difference when it comes to mindset in that aspect. Yeah. But actually, Jordan, I'm curious. What was the feeling like finding your first book?
Man, it was absolutely amazing. So just to go back a bit in time, it was basically my initial idea when I was starting with security was to just, I just knew about contests. I didn't really know much about the field. I knew that was called Arena. You could earn some money out of it from contests. And I was like, okay, I still had plans to go to university. And it was just my idea. I will get somewhat good in it. I will just start doing contests, like, you know, every now and then, just making a little bit on the side so I can live a normal life. Like, my goal was to probably make, what, $1,500, $2,000 a month. This was actually my real goal. And I was actually really skeptical whether that's actually a realistic scenario. So I was studying security, and I stumbled upon a random project, which I decided, okay, might as well, while reading the report, I might as well just do an audit of it. And I did an audit of it, and I found a critical, which was not in the report, and I was like, damn, okay, if I'm not missing anything, that's amazing. So I went to report it, and long story short, it was not a live project, it was another security researcher's project for a hackathon. And he was like, okay, yeah, that's a valid bug, nice, but the code's not live, there's no real money attached to it. But yeah, he was generous enough to pay me a bounty of $500. And I remember I was actually on a vacation when he decided to pay me the bounty. And I just received a message, yo, what's your address? And I was like, as soon as I received the money, I was the happiest person on the planet. I was like, okay, this security stuff actually has potential. I did find my first book, which is also missed by another auditor. So I might be somewhat good at this, you know, kind of build a little bit of an ego. And yeah, it was just amazing. I was like, okay, as soon as I go back, I'm going to get every report out there and just audit every project out there and just find all the bugs.
That's funny. No, that's cool as well. I feel like for everybody who finds their first bug, it's like everything changes. You know, you're feeling infinitely more confident, and it's like, you know, you're doing everything you can to just make it all work. And it's that just one payment that changes everything.
Yeah, it's a real life POC. Like, it just proves you that there is money, you can get them. Like, once you find a few bugs, you realize, okay, I can't find all bugs. Like, they're not much harder to find. I just have to concentrate a little bit, spend a little bit of time, and everything will just align.
Yeah, like, if I'm able to find, like, 20%, like, I'm also able to find, like, 40% and then 50% and... like then all and then find solos
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. That's just how it is. Once you can find wild bugs, you can find all bugs. Just a matter of time.
Yeah, amazing. And also, like we already mentioned some of that, but if we can summarize that by answering this question, like there are people that have super success in half a year, for example, or in a year, and there are also, you know, other people that do that for half a year, a year, 2 years, like they really, and like assuming that they really try hard. I know that there are such people, like for example Flint. Of course, like he has some success on his end, but he says that, you know, like he's nowhere in the place that he wants to be, and I know that he spends a lot of time on it. What do you think, like what differs, like those two people, like the one who like has great success over a year and the other guy that really tries really hard and has no success on that?
So first of all, I just want to say Flint is an amazing person, like absolutely love his journey and he should continue. But the thing about it is, I do not necessarily agree that you shouldn't compare yourself to other people's overnight successes. Like, you should, in fact, do that, in my opinion. Because the thing is that you should aim higher. That's it. If you see somebody succeeded, yeah, there might be some story behind it, but you shouldn't just tell yourself, we have different stories. Like, I shouldn't push myself too hard. No, you should actually push yourself too hard. That's if you want to achieve something great, you have to be hard on yourself. And you have to compare yourselves to others to make sure you're on the right path. So yeah, obviously, if you've been 6 months in the field and stuff is not as good as you'd like it to be, probably you have been doing something suboptimal. Like you have not done the best things that you could possibly do. So maybe just some advice to anyone who feels to be in such a situation. Just step back, look at where you are, look at what you're doing, look at your game plan, and just try to analyze what's wrong, because usually there is something wrong, which usually you've been doing on autopilot. Like this is actually accurate for all fields, for all people. Most of the times, most of the stuff that we do is on autopilot. So just taking the time every now and then to just analyze what you have been doing subconsciously on autopilot, and just adjusting that will help you.
Yeah, like my personal story here is, like recently I took like 2 weeks off of all the thing, now just to zoom out, analyze my performance, you know, what I do bad, what I, you know, could improve on. And I realized that, for example, I have my goals, you know, how many hours I spend on auditing per day, for example. Let's say this is like 4 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, like doesn't really matter. But I realized that what I did all this time, I measured my performance based on the time I spent on it, not based on the goals. Like, for example, lines of code analyzed, resolving the amount, specific amount of audit tags and things like that. Because it's super easy to fall into this trap that you are doing something and you don't even realize that you are doing it wrong. Like in my case, it was like, and then I realized that, okay, like many times I'm spending the time on it, but it's suboptimal. I could do better, you know, and I'm not really, looking at it from the things that get me to my end goal the quickest. But, you know, like sometimes you are in this experience and you are not seeing things around. And this is super cool what you said. Like sometimes give yourself space to zoom out and, you know, think again, you know, what are you subconsciously doing bad?
Yeah, exactly. As long as you do this stuff, you will achieve greatness. Like, also, like, just some final note regarding this, like, no, you should realize that nobody is greater than you. Like, everything you see other people have done it, they're in others better than you. They may have spent a bit more time, but they're not better than you. So you should, one, be harsh on yourself, know that you can do everything pretty much, and just be able to analyze yourself and criticize yourself. Be honest with yourself. Like, just if you're like, as I said, if you've been spending 7 hours a day and you do not see the results, you should be able to be honest with yourself to be, okay, I'm not actually there for these 7 hours. I'm not actually doing any good work. I'm just staring at my screen.
Yeah.
Exactly. And reflecting on those, you know, specific time frames where you, for instance, didn't do as good on a contest is very important. I mean, like you're saying, reflection in general is very important. And I agree with everything that you said, as well as you, Del. I don't want to repeat everything because I'll literally just be repeating, but yeah.
Yeah, like one final note on that, I'd like to add for everyone that is experiencing that, don't be hard on yourself. Like, this is your journey. You just have to, you know, every now and then check, you know, what do you need to improve on? But this is a journey. Like, if you already knew, you know, what worked for you and how to get to the top, you would be already on the top. So yeah, don't compare it to the others. Just do your stuff, verify that you are doing and improving with each week, and we will finally get there.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter on the person, you know. Some people like to compare themselves to somebody else and kind of set like a challenge, whereas for certain individuals, it'll be detrimental to do so, and it'll, you know, create a negative emotional state. So realistically, do what suits you best and makes you feel the most confident and the best, you know, overall.
On the similar note, I have a question. Jordan, if you knew what is the most important thing you do and you don't currently realize that makes you so successful in security research?
I believe it is the ability to just do the work when you have to do the work. Like, I do believe this is one of my strongest aspects, if I could call that. Like, if there is work to be done, the work will be done. Like, it doesn't matter. I may need to spend like 16 hours a day. I will do that. And I believe everybody should become this person, this type of person. Everybody should be able to do that. Because sometimes, well, life forces you to work 16 hours a day. That's just about it. And you should be able to do that. You shouldn't be like, oh, I want to work 5 hours a day, and if the stars align, I will become great. No, that's not how it works.
I love this. I love this because this is very philosophical, in my opinion. You give a lot of importance to discipline, and it's only right to do so.
Yeah, so most of the advice that I can give is just general advice. Like, you can take it out of the context of this podcast, you can take it to absolutely any field, and it will suit you best. Like, just... you need to be disciplined. It's as simple as that.
Like, just show up. It will suck, but with time, it will suck less and less. And, like, finally, you know, you will get used to that.
Yeah, and if you don't show up, your life will actually suck more. So, you know, you do something bad in the short term, but in the long term, you're doing yourself a favor.
Yeah, 100%.
So, Jordan, based on everything that we've spoken about, if there was to be one tip that you would give to somebody new, who is starting out web security, what would it be? Other than, you know, being disciplined, for instance, because to be honest, you gave out a lot of alpha. But if there was to be one very important thing, which, to be fair, it might be discipline, you might actually answer with the same answer, but if there was just one tip that you would want to give, that's like the most important, what would it be?
Well, to give a different answer to everyone who is new, to everyone who is a beginner, spend... as soon as you can get to audits, start doing audits. Don't spend too much time on reports. Don't spend too much time on CDFs. Don't spend too much time on anything else, but just doing audits. That's as good as you can. That's the best advice you can actually hear. Like, the sooner you get to do contests, the sooner you get to actually see what you've missed, the sooner you'll become great. That's it.
Because a lot of people get stuck in tutorial hell, right?
Yeah. Like, I can see so many people enjoying doing CDFs, No, there are these security races. Yeah, they're amazing. It's a cool thing to do on the side, but if you really want to progress, that's not the optimal way. You have to do a contest, you have to do audits, you have to get the feedback. And if you have some spare time and you find it's like fun or something, okay, do the CTFs, do whatever you find pleasing. But if you want to be successful, you should do audits.
Very nice. This is also a random question, but do you... first test?
I think I first tested like probably twice or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't really find it as useful. Like, I can see some people saying that it's quite useful. I don't really do.
like the only times I've used it was in some specific code bases where there was like just a lot of mass and a lot of rounding downs, and it was just running in different directions, and I was wondering, okay, this has to be broken, right? So I decided the best way is that I'm not going to spend too much time trying to break it. I can just run a single fast test and see if that invariant breaks. And yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is like prime example of like know your tools and like use them whenever they're needed. And yeah, I probably should mention it before, but you reached the rank of lead security researcher in Spearbeat. Like, congrats on that. This is like huge thing, definitely. And like the even more crazy thing is that you joined Spearbeat, if I'm not mistaken, in April. So it took you 2 months from security researcher to the highest rank of lead security researcher in Spearbeat. Like,
yeah,
this is unbelievable. Like, I know people that are there like for over a year, like 2 years, probably, and like they didn't reach this rank. So how did you do that, man?
Oh, there's no secret sauce. Like, we'll get to the idea from earlier. As long as you can provide value, you will get paid or promoted or whatever that's in the situation. So basically, I should say it first. Huge thanks to Zach Obrant. He was the one who got me a spare bit. He was the one who recommended me. And I'm just extremely grateful for that. But yeah, I initially got as a security researcher. And my initial goal was essentially, okay, I need to become lead security researcher as soon as possible. That's the only goal. That's my main goal. I have nothing that should get in my way. So I was like, okay, how do you do that? Well, I need to prove myself that I am capable of getting being that role. So I knew that I had the skills. Like, it may sound like a bit egotistic or whatever, but like, I knew I had skills. I just had to prove them that I have the skills. And this was just all about showing them, you know, doing every audit on time, being as communicative as possible. Just I had this goal to actually outperform everyone else in the team audit. I knew it was a team audit, but I was like, okay, I need to prove myself. I need to outperform these people who are actually absolutely amazing researchers. But yeah. And as soon as I got like one or two good audits with them, I think they saw the potential, they saw the good feedback, and they wanted me to actually get promoted. So they gave me more room to prove myself. And that's what I actually did. Because the thing is that I did get promoted in 2 months, but these 2 months were actually 7 or 8 separate audits. So this is basically getting, like, no other security researcher has had like such amounts of audits in such short time. And they were just constantly getting me on different audits. And yeah,
wow, like, this is very impressive. And like, especially what you said, like, try to be like the best version of yourself on each audit. Like, people will see that. Like, yeah, 100%. Okay, so I have 2 last questions for you, and then like we will quickly, you know, move on to discuss some of the most interesting issues of May. My first last question is, what are your thoughts in general on DeFi protocols? Are you using any of them?
Well, to be honest, like, the biggest drawback of being an auditor is that I'm extremely paranoid in regards of what projects I'm using. So there's basically like, what, 2 or 3 protocols that I'm not afraid to use. And is that because I've spent too many hours on them just auditing them? So if there's actually a bug in them, I'd be like, okay, I deserve to get trained, you know. And these are like Uniswap and Velodrome, because I've just spent too many hours on them. If there is a bug out there, all right, I'm okay with that risk. But yeah, regarding most DeFi protocols, to be honest, I don't see much value in most of them. Like, most of them are just repeating the same thing over and over again. We're not saying anything, like, novel.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of getting repetitive. But to be honest, I'm not, like, blaming anyone. I can't really see any new use cases. Like, any use case that could be out there, we've already done it. So like I think we should focus more maybe not just trying to innovate some of them, but like maybe trying to actually show the world like why is this thing good? Maybe like just try to onboard the next billion people users. Yeah.
No, I agree. It's like there's a lot of like useless L2s, arguably, right? I feel that's pretty on par with what you're saying. And I feel like maybe it's a case of also a lot of business owners trying to be first come, first serve in the space before it, you know, completely reaches adoption. I feel like that plays a massive, you know, role in it as well. But I definitely do agree with what you're saying, that there's a lot of like useless projects just popping up.
Yeah, and the thing with L2s is that it's actually a step back. Like, we're not progressing by using these L2s. Because I don't know if you've personally tried to onboard a new person into crypto, but like, if you have to explain them about every single different L2 that they have to get this coin, but then they have to bridge it, and it's just, you can't onboard new people like that. It needs to be simple, and currently it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I feel you on that a lot.
Because like I've had friends who have just received some crypto from who knows where, and they're like, okay, we want to transfer it, and they transfer it to the wrong network, and then it gets lost. And you have to explain to them that the money is lost. Nobody can recover it. Like there's no admin who can just revert the transaction and get your money back. Yeah. And so this is what actually scares people.
Yeah, it's scary. Like my personal story is like 4 months or half a year ago. I think like it was somewhere around 4 months. I was transferring some of my crypto to Coinbase. I wanted to withdraw it. And I sent USDC not on Polygon, but on Ethereum. And I sent $1,000. I was like, fuck. I sent it to the wrong address. Fortunately for me, like Coinbase had this particular contract deployed on many chains, and they accepted it. But I was like, damn, like I would consider myself advanced user of this freaking stuff, and I fell into this trap because it's a bit messy. The you have to first switch the network, then switch coin, or the other way around. Like this is. I always have problems with that. I always double check that, but this particular time, like, I didn't. And yeah, and it was like, come on, like it's already 2024. Like we have Bitcoin for like over 10 years now, like 2008 or 2009. I can't recall, but. And like we are still here, and the technology is in its infancy. Come on.
Yeah, and as I said, you're someone experienced. So this happening to someone experienced, like you can imagine what happened if someone new tries to get into it. Like, and especially the fact that you mentioned just Polygon, like try to explain that there is USDC and USDC.E, and like they're different stuff.
Yeah.
At the same time, they're the same. And
it's Polygon, you have USDC, USDCE, and on Coinbase, like, you don't know. Like, you have USDCE, and you see in your MetaMask that you have USDCE, but you want to, like, send USDC, and what do you do? Like, you don't know. Yeah. So, amazing. Jordan, what are your next goals?
Okay, well, that's a good question. Well, to be fair, I don't really have an exact goal in mind, which might not actually be good. For now, I can just see myself, doing all this, working with Burbit. It's nice work. I enjoy doing it. I don't get overworked. So I can see myself doing that for some indefinite time. I'd love to go back to book hunting at some point. Like, I really do want to get that 7-figure bounty. Like, it's no easy task, but I just want to at some point get to do that. But yeah, for now, I can just see myself, relaxing, taking work from Spurbit, just enjoying life.
Yeah, I mean, you've got many years left anyway, Jordan. Like, you're in a very good position.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly,
you've got
a very good
test.
Sponsor, Jordan. I really like your mindset. No, but it's actually really cool. It's really cool to just always hear different perspectives from auditors, you know, those who are successful, those who are unsuccessful. Everybody brings something to the table with what they're saying, and I value that a lot.
Yeah, of course. By the way, just another to mention that it's this communication with different researchers which actually got me to be in this position right now, because like last year I did connect with so many great researchers at NIFI Security Summit, and this was a thing that actually opened my mind to get the, how the field really is, to get what is the real potential in the world. So yeah, it's always great to connect with different researchers. You have a ton to learn from every one of them. You should just know from what advice to take, what do you take with a grain of salt. So yeah, if anybody out there is in the space, I highly suggest you get to connect with people. Like, and even if you're not in the space, like in general, just connecting with people, always a good advice.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's move to some of the things that happened in May. Like one of them is Solana NFT Frenzy. We had like constantly, you know, this chain of, sometimes we do have like ERC20 frenzy, we have like NFT frenzy, and it just juggles. And recently we have this frenzy on Solana, and like with every craze, there is like possibility to, you know, find some rug pull, and this was actually what happened in May. I think that many problems that we don't have on Ethereum is on Solana, specifically like on Solana. Like on Ethereum, this is basically granted that you have your contracts verified and you can check the code of the contract. However, on Solana, like, there is no such thing. Like, you are interacting with the thing that you don't know what will really do to your wallet, and you're just hoping that it won't rug you, and sometimes it does. I think that this craze started with Ethereum spot ETF approval. And yeah, as always, like, just people were screwed. Like, I know that Pump.fun, this is one of the NFT markets on Solana, was also rugged by their own former employee who knew how the algorithm worked. And what he did, he just like gamed the algorithm. This is amazing. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that Solana has many things to learn from Ethereum. Like, somehow, I do feel that Ethereum is, you know, a bit more grown up than Solana. What do you guys think?
So, to be honest, Solana, I mean, I'll say it's in a pretty good spot, right? In terms of the market, it's a pretty good coin, for what I can say. The network itself is also very nice. It's built up on Rust as well, which is a bonus, depending on how you view it. Solana overall, I mean, I trade as well. I degen trade, so I'm a bit experienced with Solana. Honestly, if anybody that's watching this, or even you, Del or Jordan, who traded back in 2021 during the bull run, I feel like BSC was a way better chain for a bull run as what Solana is kind of going towards right now, because a lot of people are calling that there's going to be a bull run on Solana, for instance. I think Solana would be pretty bad for that, mainly for what you said earlier, where you can't really view the contracts that you're interacting with, and therefore this feeds back into the rug pulls. I feel like when you have a bull run, you need to be able to view a token's contract code. Otherwise you're not really going to hit a bull run at all, because there's going to be constant rugs, especially on a chain like Solana. I think additionally as well, you've got a lot of people who are kind of sniping on it. Then you've got a lot of MEV worker going on Solana. It's very hectic. And to be honest, this convert right here is not really too security focused. It's more sort of the general principle and functionality of Solana, and just how it's not really super beneficial especially when we take into account the rugs that occur on it. Honestly, it's quite crazy. I don't know. But the rugging problem on Solana is quite big. Yeah. I remember finding out that you can't view the contract code like accurately on Solana. And I was like, what? Like, how are you meant to know what contract you're actually interacting with? How do you know you're not just going to get drained or dumped on, you know, by a specific admin having access over a function that you've got no knowledge of? It's, you know, it's quite crazy.
To be honest, like, I maybe do not necessarily agree with, like, some of the stuff you said. Like, mm-hmm. because I believe that you're a bit, I don't know, because I like, auditing dude. Mm-hmm. Because how many people do you actually think check the contracts before interacting with them?
Yeah, like, not a lot at all.
It's just us. Nobody really cares.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
And I'm going to give you another example. Like, when you go and, I don't know, you go on Amazon, do you really care what's happening behind the hood? Do you really care what's the code behind it? You don't really care. So, and that's how most people see it, I believe.
That is true. But, people see it in a simplistic way.
Yeah, but I mean, I do believe Solana has some good potential. Because the thing is that the user experience there is better. That's just fact. There's no layer to use. It's just so much simpler and easier and done better. And at the same time, they do manage to be onboarding new people. But as I just said, it's most of it goes to rug pulls, which is... Now, we're yet to see if these people are going to stay after getting rug pulled or are they going to quit crypto forever. So we can't know for sure if it's a net positive for the space.
Yeah. No,
apart from that, we have like Sana, Finance, Hack, and this is... Like, we spoke about these theoretical attacks, and I'm sure that this attack will be deemed as theoretical and not accepted, for example, on Immutify. Like, Solana Finance is fork of Compound V2. Like, it has well-known vulnerability that if the market is empty, you can perform donation attack on this pool. And because in Compound, all the pools are connected together, you can use the new pool to drain all the other pools. Simple story. So the Solana Finance team knew that that this vulnerability exists, and like the prevention for that is just before opening the market, open some first position, some small position, and just dump the tokens to zero others to do anything with them, so that no one else can really zero out the new pool. And the Solana Finance team did that. They scheduled like multiple governance proposals first to create a pool, then to put the money in there, and then only to start the market. Everything is, super, super cool according to the rules. But what they did is they scheduled three separate actions in their time lock controller. And anyone could execute those actions. So when the time came, the attacker, what he did, he just executed first and third action, drained the pool, and left the second transaction. So he picked only those transactions that allowed him to actually perform this attack because the pool was zeroed out. Ouch. I'm sure on Immutify it won't be accepted. Come on.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, it actually depends, because like if you see that the transactions were scheduled and anyone would be able to call them, that's absolutely a valid issue. Though it wouldn't be best to contact Immutify, but rather you should just try to get the phone number of the protocol team and just call them instantly. That's an urgent task, But the thing is, it's just a dumb admin error, and it's an unacceptable dumb admin error. Like, you shouldn't be in the position to control so many funds if you don't have these like basic concepts and basic best practices known and used in your protocol. Also, this also points out to the issue that anything that can be fixed on a contract level should be fixed on a contract level, and not just hoping that you'd be the first to deposit in the pool and just try to get the fix on a contract level and then care about the rest.
But yeah, honestly, the attack is so specific that I don't want to like point fingers or blame it on the team, but kind of seems like an insider attack, not gonna lie. Obviously, you know, take it as you wish, don't take my word for it, but it sounds like someone that it would be is exploited by someone from inside the team, because do really attackers watch and see, oh, there's a time lock, can everybody call the time lock, just wait for center to line? I don't know, just food for thought maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a strong 50-50. It can definitely happen just out there in the wild, but from an insider perspective, it can also happen. It's very likely.
But because the thing is, insider attacks happen so much. Like,
yeah.
Though it's not public, you don't realize it, but it's just so convenient. And yeah, because if just the protocol says, okay, we've got back to law enforcement and we're trying to get your funds back, do we really know if that's actually going on? Not really. And the thing is that they could just pull the regular trick, you know, hack themselves, say that they're after the hacker, then return 90% of funds and leave Tenno's body. Congrats, you've just taken 10% of your TVF from your users absolutely for free.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's definitely still Bob Tenno.
Guys, Jordan is
okay.
So
I will just. Wear my tinfoil hat right now. Yeah, but this is actually, I think that we already discussed it before. Like, you never know who the hacker really is. Like, even if there's private key compromise, like, how do you know who that person really is? Maybe this is just a dev that had access to the private key that held like millions of dollars. Like, would you risk it for a biscuit?
I think you always, like, another thought I had is also just how many white hats just could be black hats. It always really makes me curious. Like, I wish there was just a statistic for it.
Oh yeah, for sure there are a lot of gray hats. Like, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't remember which hacker it was, and it might honestly be, okay, I don't know which it was, but I remember like Zach exposing a black hat, and I just went on his Twitter and I see he follows me, he follows the space, he follows everyone, and he's active under the comments. So yeah, there's a lot of people in disguise just looking at everything we post.
It could be the Index like Finance
hacker exploited. We should get rid of that information. Yeah.
So never mind, but yeah, like you never know. Actually, like the hackers that are being exposed by Zach sometimes or by like any other means, like usually they're really young people in their 20s many times that are just in the space and are having some experiences with competitive audits, with bug hunting, and like they just decide to go, you know, through the villain path.
I think it's mainly because, you know, when you're at a younger age as well, you're very much piqued by curiosity. And you can also get away with a lot of the cybercrime laws. Like, if you break the cybercrime laws, you can get away with them if you're under 18, at least the majority of the time in the UK. I don't know about America and whatnot, or any other country in the EU, but... yeah, I feel like a lot of the younger people or younger black hats, gray hats, whatever you want to call them, it's curiosity that really gets them onto the more negative side, and just the amount of leniency that they have just before turning 18, for instance. At least that's how I view it.
To be fair, I suppose most of the hackers just don't realize how hard it will be to, you know, escape. They believe it's just, okay, they don't know my identity, they'll never find me, and they're the brilliant mastermind behind the biggest hack of the year or whatever. But in reality, it's much harder than that. Like, to be fair, like, you may seem anonymous on the blockchain, but I don't believe you can easily just
yeah, there was this I think that Zach XBT some summary that North Korea was actually able to take out $200 million out of all the scams. Like, this is not everything that they really stolen, but to launder like this big amount of money, this is like impressive. So yeah, but you have to be a state actor to do that. Like, I don't think that normal people would, you know, hire all the money mules and, you know, all everything it takes to really, you know, launder all those money. Any tips?
To be honest, you would be surprised. In Web 2, I've seen... in Web 2, I've seen quite a lot of hackers, Russian hackers specifically. They hire a lot of the mules for like Coinbase accounts, etc. And they just sell the accounts straight under the mules' names, etc. And it's a pretty common practice. It happens sometimes in the UK. It's not really as popular, though. I've seen it, you know, out of all the threat intelligence that I did, it was most prevalent in Russia. So, yeah, I mean, that's just, yeah.
Okay, so any more details you would like to add for the law enforcement?
Don't get any knowledge.
That's coming after you. Okay. Yeah, like, I think that I was just not, you know, interested in how to launder money. That's why I don't know the details. But if you wanted to, yeah, like, do this, there's probably a lot of, you know, materials on, like, dark web. Or even, yeah, some, like, dark web markets when you can do that. So, yeah.
I mean, probably using those would be the quickest way to actually fail. Like, just open methods or whatever. Because it's like, you got to think about it as well from an LE standpoint, the law enforcement standpoint. They can just purposely give you false information, advertise it on the dark web, like you're saying, and it's like you're going to fall into it. Whereas if you just do proper research, I mean, you're going to be pretty safe from it. I do know quite a lot about this because I did cybersecurity at university, and I did cryptocurrency as my final paper for my degree, and it was regarding money laundering. So... yeah, I know a fair amount of it. But yeah, it's really not as hard as you would think it is. It's quite easy. It's just the more money you have to launder, that's kind of where the problem comes in. Because small quantities, it's really easy. But obviously, if you're talking like, I'd probably say anything above maybe like $1 million, that's where it just kind of gets a bit iffy.
So, kids, if you want to launder money, please do not search dark web through Google. Oh my god. Like, a similar note, like, I think that the last topic for today, but I think that this is very important topic, is like Tornado Cash developer sentenced to 64 months in prison. Like, I think that most of the people heard this story, that the developer of Tornado Cash was sentenced. Now his trial like went on and on and on, and no one knew how it would turn out. Like, many people wish that it will turn out good for him, but actually he was sentenced to 64 months. And the thing is, like, of course Tornado Cash was used by bad people to, you know, to hide the flow of funds. But still, like, you can tell this about any of the tools. And actually, at least according to US law, is like, code is just an expression of yourself, the same as like writing literature and everything. And you cannot be sentenced for that. But he was actually sentenced in Dutch, in Denmark, under the Dutch court. And yeah, he was unlucky. And it poses a question, you know, what will happen with all the DeFi protocols and everything if, like, for example, Uniswap will start to be used by some big actors, you know, laundering money and things like that. So what's your take on that? Like, is it good? Like, should we really... like, by we, I mean, should government really do that and sentence people for writing the code that is not by itself used to exploit and steal from others.
So I can really turn into a huge conspiracy theorist right here. But I mean, quite literally yesterday or 2 days ago, I saw there was like regulation in the EU apparently coming through about how people, citizens of every single EU country will have to declare all the assets that they own. It's a fairly new proposition. Literally like 1 or 2 days ago, it came into kind of like request, let's just say. And when you kind of pair this up with the, you know, undermining of privacy of Tornado Cash, it's kind of weird how everything really, you know, the timing of all of it, it does raise questions. I really hate wording everything like this because it is just like crazy conspiracy theory. Whereas that you can't really just look at the timing of it and just shrug it away. It does raise a lot of questions. It's like everything is just, it looks like it's planned out ultimately. Another thing that I don't really like specifically regarding Tornado Cash is the fact that the government will always argue the complete negative sides of it, but we will never argue the positive sides. It's always one-sided completely. It's like they tried to say, well, Tornado Cash apparently funded terrorism, right? It enabled money laundering from threat actors, normal drug dealers, and all this stuff. But it's like, well, you can do the exact same thing with paper money. You know, a lot of people also have like fake bank accounts in the traditional world. You don't actually, like, when you argue that, you're not really doing much. Like, you're not solving any problem. And even if you do try to solve that problem, considering it's already out on the internet, somebody will just fork it. Somebody will create a replacement for it, and that's it. It's kind of like, imagine, like, what happened with Silk Road, right? Look at all the other markets that exist and just keep popping up. You're never really going to solve the problem. But, I mean, the main problem here is actually privacy. You know, we need privacy. And crypto is very big on that, but it's quite crazy to just see how you can go to prison for code. Honestly, there's quite a few problems with this in mind. But yeah, Jordan, what do you think?
Yeah, so for sure, okay, I have a bit of mixed feelings about it, and I'll explain why. Because the thing is, I do believe that Tornado Cash might have done more damage than like the positive thing that things that it has contributed to. But yeah, generally just the idea of getting prisons only because of a piece of code that you wrote is, okay, where is it gonna end? If it happens once, it's gonna happen twice, it's gonna happen a third time. And the thing is that it's just unfair. Like, but it's short, it's just unfair. I do believe that any code that can go on the blockchain should be able to do that. Everybody should be able to do anything they wish. As I said, it does not create a new problem, but rather that it just doesn't fix an old problem that has existed for years before and will exist in the future.
Yeah, in a way, it also expands it, right? Because it gives a lot of attention to it.
Yeah, and also the thing about crypto is that people say that crypto is this optimal thing for money laundering, that it's impossible to track or something like that. Well, in reality, it's much better. It's much easier to track than just, let's say, regular cash, because everything is stored on chain. You can see absolutely everything. You can analyze anything. You cannot analyze random cash transactions that go on the street.
Yeah.
Type of stuff. You cannot track it, but you can always track everything on crypto. So I think that is actually slightly better.
The only problem that you would face is if you're up against somebody who's very technical and knows essentially all the methods. That would be the only problem. Other than that, it's definitely easier. I agree.
And like, imagine tomorrow law enforcement hires Zach to just find a notorious drug dealer. It would be an easier task. But then
exactly. Imagine
the same thing tries to be done with someone who just only deals with cash. Yeah, absolutely impossible.
Yeah, and imagine that Zach has all the tools that government has. And some additional knowledge of the, you know, the Secret Service. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that it, you know, will not be good for or anyone that tries to hide, you know, in blockchain.
I'm pretty sure Zach as well on Twitter, there was a specific case that he was just, you know, investigating by himself, and FBI directly reached out to him and they constantly tried to get in contact with him. I'm 99% sure it was Zach, because he's probably, well, he's one of the best, I would say, in open source intelligence. But yeah, that, like, they were completely like sending him in emails. They were pretty much doxing him and just...
Yeah,
so it was like, yeah, yeah, it was quite crazy to see that from FBI. Yeah, I've never seen something like that before, so it was quite crazy to see Zach just give a lot of attention to that and just be like, yo, like, just leave me alone, I'm just doing what I like and that's it.
Okay, guys, I think that's all for today. It was super cool, amazing. Jordan, thanks a lot for joining. You shared a lot of great perspectives. I know, I think that people will be able to get some pure alpha also from this talk. Thanks a lot. It was, you know, the pure pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with both of you. Always amazing to connect with such great minds like you guys.
Yeah, thank you. It was amazing to meet you, Jordan. Again, like I said earlier, I like your perspective. Very inspirational as well. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you.